If you are a Gen Xer or a 90s kid or possibly the parent of one of those two groups, you might know what that sound is. That's Saved by the Bell, the candy-colored television confection with idols like Zach Morris and Kelly Kapowski and, of course, beloved nerd Screech. Behind those characters and the show's memorable storylines is Peter Engel. Engel was the executive producer for Saved by the Bell and other Saturday morning shows that followed. He remembers the exact moment that inspired his career in television.
I was 12 years old on Central Park West in Manhattan. It was, I know it was 1948, and we saw the Milton Berle Texaco Star Theater. I decided this was for me. I needed to be part of this. I had to be in television, and I fell in love.
Engel went on to produce other hits like Last Comic Standing, and he also served as dean of the School of Communication at Pat Robertson's Regent University. That's an experience in itself worth reading about. His memoir, which came out at the end of last year, is called I Was Saved by the Bell, Stories of Life, Love, and Dreams That Do Come True. And in it, Engel recalls the first version of Saved by the Bell, which was a pilot for a primetime show on NBC called Good Morning, Miss Bliss.
When Brandon Tartikoff, the young mercurial president of NBC, brought me to NBC, he was like a little younger brother to me, and he said, we can do great things. And the first thing he wanted to do was a pilot for primetime on his sixth grade teacher in Long Island, Miss Bliss, who had a major effect on his life. And in that pilot, people, it was a primetime pilot, and that pilot, people don't remember, this only aired once, was Urkel and Brian Austin Green from 90210.
Of course.
None of the kids who ended up on Bell. And that was a broken pilot. And then Brandon decided we should do it in primetime on a Disney Channel. And we did 13 episodes. It was somewhere in between. It wasn't a failure. It wasn't a success. And Disney chose not to go forward. And then Brandon wanted to add more kids and remove the teacher. And I told him to get someone else. That I didn't want to do a Saturday morning show. Who cares about Saturday morning? And the rest is television history.
Well, I want to talk a lot about some of the subtext and some of the culture behind Saved by the Bell, because it was important to a lot of young people at the time. But, you know, one thing that I always noticed about it, Peter Engel, right off the bat, the color choices in that show. I mean, Saved by the Bell was an abnormally bright, colorful show.
Yes.
It always looked to me like Skittles running around the set. And
well,
that was a choice
why.
That you made.
Well, you got to remember something. When we went on the air, Todd, our lead-ins were chipmunks, and our lead-out was Smurfs, and we got into a rabbit, a raisin, and a bear. And that was a cartoon landscape, and we were afraid no one would find us in that environment or that landscape. So what we had to do was, obviously, and Brandon and I decided that no scene would last more than 2.5 pages, because remember, it was pop, 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 pop. In those cartoon shows, and even in Sesame Street, bang, 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 bang. You look here, you look there, and we decided we had to be somewhere between that and a primetime comedy. And so, yes, the colors were, it's funny that no one else has picked that up but you. But yes, that was intentional because of our competition, which was a land of cartoons.
Well, there was a lot of social messaging in the show, like a lot of shows for young people in those days. There was a great deal of sort of social messaging embedded in the scripts, environmental messages, drinking and driving you dealt with, dealing with death.
We did an oil spill in 1992.
There's been an oil spill.
It's terrible, sir. Look what happened to Becky. Please, Becky, it's okay.
The poor thing.
It's okay. Please, sir, show us how to clean her off.
It's okay, man. She's not moving, Zach.
I know she's probably in shock. Just please help us, sir.
I'll do what I can, Zach, but... Zach, Becky's dead.
No. No.
No one was doing that kind of stuff.
And, of course, you dealt with drugs as well. This is probably the most famous scene of the most famous episode of Saved by the Bell, dealing with drug addiction and dealing with diet pills.
Pills? You mean you really are taking drugs?
I need them.
Jesse, give me those.
I need them, Zach. I have to sing.
Jesse, you can't sing tonight.
Yes, I can. I'm so excited. I'm so excited. I'm so scared.
Jesse.
It was caffeine pills. Let me explain what happened. I wrote that with Tom Tenowitz, my top producer on the show. And it was not a drug episode like the marijuana episode. It was supposed to be a peer pressure and how kids put pressure on themselves. Jesse wanted to go to Stanford. The SATs had not worked out the way she wanted. She was in every single club for her extracurricular activities. The pills were a result of that pressure. And, of course, she was singing in the Hot Sundays. When Tom and I wrote it as speed. You know, we're talking about amphetamines, speed, real drugs. And we're in the meeting with the network standards people, and they go, no way. And so Tom said, how about caffeine pills? Now, Todd, I didn't even know what caffeine pills were. I never heard of them. And I just wanted to get the heck out of the meeting. So I said, okay, caffeine pills. We never changed a word of the script. And that's why we were made fun of by people later on that it looked like she was on heroin. But the audience was riveted in the studio. They were crying. Mark Paul and Elizabeth Berkley were crying in the scene. And I kept saying, we need another take. And in the control room, they're going, no, one more. And that was the scene you just played. Of course, I didn't write 17 Jessies. Jesse. But the impact that had on my own daughter, it was unbelievable.
So, of course, you had Zach, you had Kelly, Jesse, all the other characters. Mm-hmm. But Screech, really, mm-hmm. for so many people, was where it was at. Dustin Diamond played him. And you tell the story in the book about how, of course, this kid had unbelievable natural comedic talent, but was 11 years old when he came onto your set.
Right. I misread his birth. The thing about Bell that made it so special were the kids were playing. Well, first of all, the cast was unbelievable. They were magic from day one. And one of the reasons it caught on so well was because they were playing their own ages. On 90210, Luke Perry was 29 when they started. And all the other shows with kids, they were usually multiple years older than what they were playing. I misread Dustin Diamond's headsheet with his birthday. And after the second episode, I said to Mark Paul Gosselaar, MP, I said, what's with Dustin? He's such a kid. He said, well, he's only 11. I said, he's only 11? I never would have cast him. And that would have been a tragedy because he was comic gold. Whenever a scene wasn't working well, I would write on my notes, more screech. So for Christmas, they got me a rubber stamp which said more screech.
You know, a lot of kids who are now adults took so many different things from your show. I talked to a lot of friends who watched Saved by the Bell quite a bit when they were younger. And I had one friend, a woman, who said, I had a huge crush on Zach until I finally realized that I actually wanted to be Zach so that I could get with Kelly.
Well, you know, we send all kinds of messages. I never thought of that. But, of course, that's the world we live in. Someone asked me, would we have a gay character today? I said, probably. And I also said, I don't think we could have done Belle today as a comedy, but we'd rather have to do it as a drama or something like Glee.
So that's part of the question. What do you think that show would look like now if you made it?
I think it would be a drama. Look, we broke barriers. I mean, I got the first diversity award. I'll tell you a funny story. I was one of the greatest fans of Belle, we found out, was Lin-Manuel Miranda. And in June, I was his guest in the sixth row on the aisle to see Hamilton. And afterward, we met on stage. I was only in one Saved by the Bell. Every year I was in Last Comic Standing, throwing people off. I was on our other shows. But I only did one Bell. It was at a golf course in Palm Springs. And I had this one line. And when I walked on the stage to meet Lin-Manuel after the show, he came walking towards me. And with that, in the voice I used, he said, when I make this putt, you'll owe me $1,000. And we hugged and we talked. And he said to me, you really inspired me. I said, I'm inspired by you. Look at this cast. George Washington's black, and you're Puerto Rican, and this one's that. I said, how did that happen? He said, you inspired me. He said, you won the first diversity award. I said, I did. If I only impacted my three children and Lin-Manuel Miranda, then it was a success. But I didn't. We impacted a whole generation in 85 countries. People forget that no comedy had ever gone to more than six English-speaking countries. Canada, the UK, Australia, New Zealand, etc. Bell was in 85 countries. And that was unheard of for a comedy. But every kid went to school somewhere. And they all wanted to see how the California kids lived.
So there is this huge impact on a whole generation. There are the bright colors on set that we talked about. But there are a couple of dark chapters in your book, Peter Engel. You describe, after leaving Hollywood, that you went to work for Pat Robertson, the televangelist and businessman, where you really describe one humiliation after the next, even describing yourself at one point as a convert to Christianity around Pat Robertson as the house Jew. What was that experience like?
Well, Pat was my friend. Forget politically, okay? Pat was my friend. And I was at a time in my life when everything had fallen apart. Remember, from 96 to 2001, I had six shows shooting at the same time. And all of a sudden, my wife of 20 years, my marriage went south. NBC took out a full-page ad, thanks for the memories. And Pat seemed to be, I didn't think anyone wanted me. And I was, when I say I was a house Jew, anything on, when Mel Gibson came down to screen The Passion of Christ on every subject, was this anti-Semitic or was this negative about Jews, they would always call on me. And then, of course, you read where Pat and I got in that huge fight over who was going to tell him it was too violent in the hallway. Pat says, brother, you have to tell him it's too violent. I said, why do I have to tell him? Well, you're the producer. I go, you're the head of the right, of the violent right. And we got into, it was a fun argument, whispering. So finally I prevailed that Pat had to tell him that the cut we saw was too violent.
Well, why did you end up leaving?
Leaving where?
Regent University and your...
Because I couldn't deal with it anymore. I mean... I love Pat, and I really did, and I still do, but I just couldn't deal with the business aspects of Christianity and the commercialization and the politicization of Jesus, and that's why I did my famous speech at the National Media Prayer Breakfast, which was entitled, "The Gospel of the Pentagon is Not in My Bible." And I got a standing ovation when I came out, and three people applauded among dead silence when I finished. Because I said, that's not in my Bible. Matthew's in it, Mark's in it, Luke's in it, John's in it. The Gospel of the Pentagon and of the Republican Party and Karl Rove and all these other guys are not in my Bible. And they still aren't, Todd, today.
Has that driven a division between you and some of your old friends?
Yeah, but it's okay. They're more tolerant of me, I think. I'm being really honest about this. I think they're more tolerant of me than I am of them. Because the hypocrisy, we're all hypocrites. I don't know anybody who's as far right as I was involved with those people. And yet I guess I have less empathy for them than they do for me. And that's wrong. It's wrong on both ends of the spectrum.
So you had this long career in television, Peter Engel, through, you know, the 70s, 80s, 90s, well into the 2000s. Television, though, just in the last few years, has undergone this just absolute revolution. There's this blooming in creativity and also TV budgets. It's a totally different game than when Saved by the Bell was out. What do you think of television today, and the flourishing of Netflix and Amazon and all the high quality shows that are out there?
I think it's fabulous, and I think it's this is the platinum age of television.
But don't you wish, if you had a wish, that you could be coming up now as a hotshot producer instead of 40 years ago? You know, I mean, you would have such a huge range of options ahead of you and massive budgets.
Well, budgets was never a problem. It was never a matter of the budget. It was a matter of creativity. And comedy, quite frankly, I think those new comedies on CBS is very traditional. The one with Matt Perry and the Odd Couple and the Man with a Plan, you could have taken those comedies and put them in the 80s. So in comedy, as far as I'm concerned, nothing's really changed. It's just there's much better of everything. in drama, though, between Homeland and The Crown and you name it, the just tremendous production. But that has to do with the fact that the marketplace is bigger. The tent is bigger. So the bigger the tent, the more money, although it's niche television for some. I don't think money ever changed the creativity one way or the other. I don't think if ER had $3 million more a week to spend, it could have been any better. I don't think West Wing, if it had multiple more dollars, could have been any better. I think, I'm not sure, I'm not sure that I would want to be beginning today. Hey, we had 6 million viewers and a 5-6 rating in the demo. That'd be a top 10 show in primetime network today.
Well, the book is I Was Saved by the Bell because it's by the creator of Saved by the Bell, legendary television producer Peter Engel. Thank you so much for joining us.
I'm so happy to have had the chance. Thank you.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.